I want to welcome people to the committee. It seems like ratings are dropping a bit. I'm not sure if that's a function of Dr. Golden or David Feinwachs or how the competition is going to work. Oh, sorry. Anyway, if you want to come down, the presenters for the Department of Health. And then when we get a quorum, we'll call us officially to order. We have quite a fair amount of content to go through. And then at the end, we're going to have a demonstration, which will be a scintillating telehealth demonstration of Representative Huntley if he actually comes for his exam.
Great word.
And they're actually going to do open heart surgery right here. That's going to be kind of, that'll draw ratings, get some people in here. Well, Dr. Golden, welcome to the committee. We've only bumped you twice, and we put you on first so that it wouldn't happen again. You know about good intentions. And so actually, you're even staged, if this is on, I don't know if we're on TV today, but there you are with all this medical equipment around you there, which somehow fits the topic that you're going to be discussing, and we can't even see your fellow testifier, but hello there, just wave. So, welcome to the committee, so do you have a presentation you're going to give? Oh, it just blew up.
I'm Mr. Chair.
My 12-year-old could help you if you want. He's kind of talented.
I could probably use that right about now.
See, e-health isn't as simple as you think, is it, Dr. Golden?
Just make it a little or into a slideshow.
See how easy e-health can be? It's just simple. We can design it here. People can do it everywhere. It's really easy. Oh, is that the topic of your health later? Of your topic later? Welcome to the committee, and have at it.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Golden. I am the Division Director for the Division of Health Policy. Mr. Chair, you had asked for some information on three topics. One was on e-health activities within the state. One was on provider peer grouping. And the other is some information about some of the data that we collect through our health economics program for healthcare coverage and spending. There are a fair number of slides, and in respect for the committee's time, I will try to move quite quickly.
Okay.
And please feel free to let me know if you have any questions or would like to, how you'd like to do this.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. Why don't you go ahead then? Thanks.
Mr. Chair, committee members, with regard to e-health and specifically what e-health is, I think in Minnesota, is thinking about how we use electronic health records to actually work with healthcare. This has been an area that the state has been working in quite a lot since 2004. During the 2004 legislative session, the state created an advisory body to help coordinate e-health activities, think about where we should do priorities, and think about how we can best use this technology in both the public and private sector to improve care. The e-health initiative's vision is the one that you see on the screen. Essentially, we want to accelerate the adoption and effective use of health information technologies, particularly electronic health records, to improve quality, patient safety, help to reduce costs, and really allow individuals to participate in their health care to the greatest extent possible. And I think one of the reasons that this was so important for the state is our hospitals and clinics are literally spending hundreds of millions of dollars on this type of technology. And it's going to be very important that they are working in a coordinated fashion so that these technologies interoperate with each other and are really used according to some types of best practices that really help advance the objectives for healthcare for all Minnesotans. Some of the activities that were passed by the legislature, there's a requirement that in 2011, all providers, payers, prescribers, and dispensers begin using e-prescribing according to national standards. That is one activity that is occurring right now. There's also a requirement that by 2015, all healthcare providers and hospitals have an interoperable electronic health record. Mr. Chair, I believe that you yourself had suggested that this maybe would be 2012. We had a compromise to get to 2015 in order to ensure that our provider community would have adequate time to make the investments and start to implement this into their care. And to help with that, the Department of Health was tasked with putting together a variety of statewide plans to help facilitate the use of these technologies and help provide some guideposts for coordination. Additionally, we are working on a variety of standards. For the most part, standards are set at the national level. What we generally do with the standards is take a look at what they are trying to do at the national and federal level. We work with our provider community to make sure that those standards are appropriate and fit for the care and activities that they are trying to do. And then we avail ourselves of opportunities to provide input to the federal level.
And Dr. Golden, just a comment about that. I think that we talked about trying to get the standards early, but I'm still remain concerned about the ability of some small clinics to comply with this. So we'll talk about that later, but just to keep the discussion going. So thanks.
Mr. Chair and committee members, one of the things that we wanted to think about as we were putting together the requirement for all providers to have interoperable records by 2015 is what would a model look like? Quite clearly, in order to have an interoperable electronic health record, the very first thing you need to do is adopt one and have an actual health record. And in that, there are a variety of activities that can help make sure that the technology in your purchases are really meeting the needs of your particular practice, and you see some of those steps. Some of the most bang for the buck in using an electronic health record is to really think about how to use that health record to improve care. So if you're using an electronic health record as simply a substitute for paper, it's probably a large waste of money, to be rather honest. It's just not efficient. What you really want to do is you want to make sure that you're using an electronic health record as a tool so that it allows you to have reminders that help you think about when you want to schedule patients for particular follow-up. You might want to use it to help remind you of some of the best practices. You also probably want to use it to do things electronically that are more cumbersome and problematic on paper. To your point, Mr. Chair, that is an effort for clinics and hospitals. They have to think about how to redesign the care delivery, think about the processes that they are using to be able to do that. But I think what we have very good evidence for is for clinic and hospitals that have actually spent the time thinking about how they can really design their care activities around these types of technologies. They have found them to be very helpful in delivering high-quality care to their patients. And then finally, of course, it is to exchange information. And for the most part, all of the activity in Minnesota that we have been working on around exchange is really the exchange of health information for the treatment of the patient. So this is really information that is flowing between caregivers that might have various roles in treating a patient. The first there is to make sure that your systems are ready, and then to really exchange and interoperate. There is a slide that is probably impossible to read here. It is also a handout that is in your packet. I believe it is probably stapled to the very end of the packet. It's just there. I think this is an example of effective use. And so when you think about how might you use an electronic health record more effectively and do some of the various activities, these give some examples of the types of ways that a healthcare provider, a clinic, a hospital will want to think about incorporating this tool and technology into their care delivery. I'm not going to go through this, but I think what you really are seeing here are ways to use this technology above and beyond a simple piece of paper. What have we been doing to help with some of the adoption and effective use? The department has published a number of guides and tools for providers looking at some of the barriers to adopting, particularly some of the financial barriers, looking at some ways to begin moving toward interoperability. We put together a lot of useful information to think about how providers could meet the e-prescribing mandate that was in place. We had a committee that was made up of many practicing physicians that helped us put together some practical guides for the effective use. And then we have been working with the community in our strategic and operational plans for the exchange of health information. I know one thing that this committee and Representative Gottwald's committee has been very interested in is the question of well, what have we done with this? How have we succeeded? What are the results associated with this? One of the things that Minnesota has been doing as part of our quality effort is to collect information with regard to where we are both in the adoption and use of electronic health records. Minnesota's data, which comes from over 1,000 clinics, shows that about 67% of them have an electronic health record installed and being used by the clinics. About another 9% are in the process of moving down this path, and we still have some that are working toward this but don't have one in place yet. To give you a sense of how that compares nationally,
actually we have a quorum now, so you can actually be on the record. And Representative Huntley, before he asks his question, we'd like to move the minutes. Any discussions about that? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thanks for that help. And Representative Huntley, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Golden, on the electronic health records by clinic, 67% of the clinics have them. Do you have an estimate of what percentage of the physicians are in those 75% of the clinics? My guess is it's way over 90%.
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, you know I don't have that, but you are correct. The percentage of physicians and other caregivers would be substantially higher because most of the large integrated delivery networks would have this type of technology installed. And so by that count, it would be much higher. I can certainly work with staff to see if we have some estimates of that available. I don't have those right here today, though.
Russell, it might look like the returns coming from your neck of the woods there, that some small county, some small providers, as a, some of those would be the hard ones to get. So, thanks. Go ahead and keep going.
Again, taking a look at the results, the 67% we actually are very confident in with regard to the physician clinics, because that is nearly a census of the clinics operating in Minnesota. However, I thought it would be helpful to look at some national comparisons. The CDC recently did a survey that was a national survey and found that Minnesota is leading the nation in the adoption and use of electronic health records with 80.2. And so I think what you're seeing here is the difference between these numbers is that they are doing a sample and they tend to get larger clinics and don't quite have some of the small clinics. But again, I think the most important point is what the CDC really gives us is an opportunity to compare ourselves with other states. And by that token, Minnesota is leading the nation in the adoption and use of electronic health records. Another thing that I think is helpful in understanding where Minnesota has been on these issues is in July of 2010, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality described Minnesota as the most aggressive state in promoting the adoption of standards-based electronic health records. And again, I think this is an area that has had broad bipartisan support from both the legislature and the governors. And so I think that what you are really seeing here is that aggressiveness is paying off in these technologies being adopted and ultimately integrated into the new care delivery models that the provider community is working on. Another example that I thought might be helpful, this is 2009 data that we have obtained from SureScripts. We anticipate that 2010 will be out shortly and expect to see jumps very similar to what we see between 2008 and 2009. But in 2007, before the state had its e-prescribing mandate, physicians and prescribers were doing e-prescribing at about 3% within the state. By 2009, it has jumped up to 38%. And again, I think when we get the 2010 data here in a few months, you're going to see another large jump. I'm anticipating that it'll be over 50%. Likewise, if you look at our pharmacy community, they too have substantially improved. Working toward the 2011 mandate from about 57% up to 82%. So again, I think what we're seeing is that the community effort and the organizing around this and the discussions have really helped our healthcare community move forward in adopting some of these practices.
And Dr. Golden, before you get to the next section, there's been some interest in trying to work with some of the prior authorization and some of the pharmacy on this electronic thing, and so we'll take that offline, but just some interest in working with that. And so just maybe you've heard about that. So we want to keep efficient for the providers too as they do their work, and I know you're all for that. So,
Mr. Chair, we have had some discussions with that. We have had some opportunities to talk with Mr. Spazzetto about that as well, and I think we have given him some practical advice on ways to help push that forward on that issue, but we would be more than happy to continue those discussions.
Yeah, great. And just for a matter of timing, we've reserved about 1:15 for this part of the thing, so you're really good for time. And I think if you have to lean anything up, it'd just be the health economics part. But then we're going to do the exchange discussion about that after that, and then we're going to have Epson Huntley get wired up and sent down to Mayo by electronic means or something. So go ahead, keep going.
Mr. Chair, I've had enough coffee that I'm really wired up.
So keep going. Mr. Chair, I was planning on switching over to the topic of provider peer grouping. I don't know if you had anything else you wanted on e-health or discussion.
There are questions, members? I know one ongoing concern I have is about how to help. I just mentioned the results from the outlying precincts up in the range, which we always wait for and with anticipation. But there's some small clinics outstate that I know there's some grants that are available, but they don't qualify for some of those. So I know there's some small monies we have at the state level that we provide, but I'm concerned that that's going to be an issue coming up. So just if that's for now, or do you want to comment about just like a 30-second comment about that?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I think we share some of your concerns, and I think that one of the things we want to really make sure is that we don't end up with the haves and have-nots when it comes to using some of these types of technology. At the state, we do have a revolving loan fund that we have used to help provide interest-free loans to safety net providers and rural clinics and hospitals to help support some of these technologies and to put them into place. We have also been quite aggressive in trying to help safety net providers, FQHCs, and others look for opportunities to access federal money. There has been a fair amount of money that has flowed through HRSA, particularly for community clinics and federally qualified healthcare clinics. We have done everything we can to try to help them access that money. Additionally, within our area of the health department, we have the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care, and they have a variety of grant programs that are more generalized. So, for example, we have the Rural Hospital Capital Improvement Grant. One of the opportunities for hospitals under that grant program has been to think about how they might use some funding available for that to help support some of their efforts around these areas. So I think what we have tried to do across all of our programs is find as many opportunities for those clinics and hospitals to take advantage of existing funding sources that we have available to them.
And I think maybe later you can submit for us, you did a survey and it's like 90% responded or so, and maybe the breakdown of how those, what's your view about who's yet on EHR'd? You said 67% of the clinics and so on. So not for now, but for later. Representative Kiffmeyer has a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Golden, in regards to e-prescribing, the justification for the expenditures was that the outcome would be safer, more accurate, better patient care. So just putting in place a system, the question is it getting the desired outcome of accuracy and reducing prescribing errors? Do you have some facts, numbers, statistics at this point to show that the significant investment of money into doing this is having the desired outcome?
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, I don't have any Minnesota-specific information with regard to the ultimate outcome, which is increased patient safety. There is quite a lot of national data that has looked at that very issue. And one of the interesting things about that question is there is clearly improved patient safety and outcomes. Where you see the largest patient safety is when you have a allergic reaction. So, for example, one of the stories that's often out there is the prescription of sulfur drugs. And so if I'm allergic to sulfur drugs, one of the best advantages of the electronic health record is that when a prescriber goes to issue me an antibiotic that is based on sulfur, it will immediately pop up with a red flag that says you might want to reconsider. There's a known allergy here. So with regard to those areas, we've seen quite a lot of success. The other area where we've seen some pretty good success is when the prescription is actually going from the clinic to the pharmacy. By going electronically, you avoid a wide variety of transcription errors and the like. Where we have seen some challenges is actually who's entering the information directly into the electronic health record. And again, I think it starts to get to the need to redesign care. When you were using a paper pad, it wasn't infrequent that the physician or the prescriber would simply dictate it orally to someone else to write down and then sign it. What we have found in an electronic health record is that greatly reduces some of the patient safety aspects associated with using the electronic health record. And I think some of our best healthcare systems are really thinking about, again, how do they use this technology? How do they have to work with their staff to change how they're doing things? And the ones that are getting the best outcomes are the ones that are most successful at being adaptable to those types of issues and technologies.
Yep. That's good. Thank you.
Well, thanks. Yeah, why don't you move on to peer grouping then?
Sure. Mr. Chair, committee members, provider peer grouping is a system that was passed in the 2008 health reform bill, and I think that the goal for provider peer grouping is one that this committee has concerned itself with in a variety of presentations and discussions thus far this session. What we know is that just because you spend more for health care doesn't necessarily mean that you are getting better quality. And that, in fact, if you want to care both about cost and quality, you probably should measure both of them. You should measure them in a way that makes sense. And then it probably makes sense to really think about how do you pay for health care based on the outcomes. So based on higher quality and based on more efficient health care spending and use of dollars. And the other thing that we know is that for consumers to make better decisions, they're going to need information. So if consumers are going to have increasing responsibilities for their healthcare decisions, the providers that they're choosing, the dollars that they're spending, they really need some information to help with some of those resources. And again, finally, as I was saying, we need to find ways in the healthcare system overall to really pay for the outcomes, the value, and not simply for the volume. Well, what is provider peer grouping? What you see here are some definitions that are actually in the statute. Essentially, it is a system for publicly comparing healthcare provider performance on measures of both cost and quality. Much of this activity has been going on in a variety of ways in the private sector already. Health plans are often have techniques for doing this. But what the statute really wanted us to have was a uniform method of calculating the provider's relative costs, which is both the healthcare spending and the resource use. So it includes both what you pay for a particular service and the amount of services that you're getting, as well as the relative quality of care. The statute also requires that both healthcare spending and healthcare costs be risk adjusted to take into account severity of illness, population differences, demographic differences, and the like. I think a couple of aspects that are important about this is that it is uniform. You know, as I say, it is occurring in the marketplace today, but for providers it can be frustrating because they can often have one payer telling them that they're in one spot, and for other payers they're telling them that they aren't as good or that they're substantially better. The other advantage of this particular system is it really takes advantage of the fact that when you start to collect data that is market-wide, that covers both private payers, Medicaid, public programs, and Medicare, that you have a much larger data source that really allows for much better comparisons that are market-wide. The law anticipates that we would take a look at two types of comparisons. The first is something that we is called total care. And the idea of total care is if you think about a hospital or a clinic, they have a wide range of services that they provide. So when you look at a hospital or clinic overall, the total care cost and quality would be looking at their total package of services and offerings that they have. That is where we are focusing most of our initial effort, and that is what the statute calls for publishing first. The second issue is that there are certain conditions which tend to be either very costly conditions or they tend to be high volume conditions, particularly some of the chronic conditions which are driving the cost. If you really want to get to better care and better cost, you really need to make sure that you address some of the chronic conditions. And so we also are required to do peer grouping for condition specific. And here you see the six conditions which we will be dealing with initially. So if you're going to look at peer grouping and do this, what do you need? Well, the very first thing, if you're going to assess quality, you need some information about quality. Our preference, of course, is for outcomes that actually look at what happened to the patient, the outcome for that patient. In the absence of that, you want to look at some process measures. So, for example, if I show up in the emergency room with a heart attack and I'm supposed to get an aspirin, did I get that aspirin? There are some structures, and then also patient experience. Certainly, we don't want to improve cost and quality at the expense of the patient's experience.
Mr. Golden, I do have a question for you. On those outcomes, do you also include things like infections, how long the stay is or the care is, readmissions? Do you include that also in these quality measures?
Madam Chair, yes. We do have some measures that are associated with infections, and we also are looking at how to best incorporate readmission rates into the calculations for both total care as well as for some of the appropriate condition-specific.
Okay, thank you.
When you want to look at the cost, I think it's important to look at first the utilization of healthcare services, so which services were provided and how much, and then also the pricing information. And for pricing, what we are actually using for this system is dollars that change hands. So when you're looking at the price is what the health plan paid to the provider, as well as what the enrollee is responsible for paying out of pocket. So these are not charges, these are actual dollars flowing in within the system. The reporting of the data, you know, one of the most important things...
Mr. Golden, I'm sorry. Okay. In regards to that pricing information, another question for you. When you do, whether it's total cost or just pricing information, do you include, say, if it's a hospitalization, do you also include the ancillary radiology, maybe some physical therapy, or do you, or, you know, are you comprehensive in your total care or total cost, or, you know, for that area, say it's a total knee replacement? There's a variety of things that go in with that bundle of care, you might say. Are you comprehensive in that regard?
Madam Chair, we are comprehensive with regard to that. What we are using to get the cost data are really healthcare claims. And so for a particular patient, we would have certainly their hospital claim, but we also have a way of linking and tracking that to also their other types of services. So if there's ancillary services that were provided in the hospital that aren't otherwise included in a DRG or something, we would have that information available to us through the claim. Also, if they were to receive services in a clinic setting that would be associated either with their condition or their episode of care, we would also have that, and we have ways of linking those pieces of information together to really look at the total cost of care associated with the episode.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Golden.
So in thinking about reporting the data, I guess even before getting to the reporting of the data, I think one of the most important things for us to think about is to make this data useful, we really need to engage the stakeholders associated with these efforts. So we have spent a lot of time and effort thinking about who needs to use these data, who are being evaluated by these data, and how do we make sure that they're participating in the development of this system and buying into what this is about. And so we have worked a lot with the hospitals, the clinics, the payers, and others to really develop this system along. And so what we will need to do once we have the results from the first round is we will need to first distribute those to providers. We are doing this analysis at a clinic and hospital level. So for the most part, the results would go to clinics and to the hospitals. Gives those types of organizations the ability to look at the data to make sure that we haven't made some type of silly mistake where we have just missed their population or don't have them fully included. They have the opportunity to let us know and appeal the results if there are concerns about the accuracy of the data. Once we have worked through those issues with the provider community, then the results will be publicly reported.
And Dr. Golden, I have another question for you. In regards to that data, there are times when due to your, you may have made a very good effort as a physician or doctor or so on, but you have somebody who decides they're going to continue persisting or not follow the doctor's orders or the nurse's orders or something. Do you have something that factors in here, an allowance for the fact that even though they've had a best effort, the response may not have been the best, the outcome might not have been best, but not necessarily due to the effort of the medical establishment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, for individual patients, we don't have a mechanism to do that. But there are mechanisms to risk adjust the data in ways where we know that there might be some concerns that would cross larger populations. So I think really an example of what you're talking about might be some of the patient compliance issues. So for example, a physician tells me to stop smoking, but for whatever reason, I choose not to stop smoking. To be honest, with regard to the risk adjustment, at this point, we aren't collecting sufficiently detailed information to be able to take into account that individual circumstance. But there are other types of patient compliance issues that are picked up in the risk adjustment that we're doing. So, for example, if you were to look at perhaps low-income individuals who perhaps have more transportation problems, so some of their non-compliance might be associated with their inability to get around as easily as others. That tends to be picked up when we risk adjust for the payer mix, which is a proxy for income, as an example.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Golden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've got about 8 minutes left for this segment, just for your information, Madam Chair. And so we'll just, people can read the peer grouping at home. It's fascinating. And I mean, the other health economics piece if we get carried away on this. When you report to clinics and hospitals, are you going to break it out by provider just so they know who's driving it at their particular hospital, high utilization or low utilization? Or is it only by the entire hospital that they're getting that information?
Mr. Chair, we are still working through some of those issues. We are having conversations with the Minnesota Medical Association and the Hospital Association to sort through that. Certainly one of the things that we have heard from the Medical Association and their members is that for them, they would really like to see the data that they're getting to be actionable. And so at this point, we certainly have that on our to-do list, and we are going to work with them to think about what's the best way to do that. We don't have that today, but we do want to provide them information in a way that is as actionable as possible within the analyses.
Madam Chair, and so do you have the data by clinician, or is it just all put in a big pot by site?
Mr. Chair, we have it by clinician, but there are a number of methodological challenges in doing grouping profiling by physician. And so what you find is that the reliability and validity of the data is better at a clinic level. One of the challenges that you have is thinking about just trying to figure out where a particular person fits within a clinic. So really, the problem comes in when you have a medical group. So you have a medical group that might use one number for billing. And within that medical group, they have 15 clinics. And within those 15 clinics, they have 100 physicians that practice at multiple locations. So, yes, we do have information about the individual physicians. How we might be able to package that together to be most useful to the clinics and the systems is something that we're having ongoing discussions with the medical community.
Madam Chair, just one more question. Mm-hmm. But I hope that even though the data is mediocre in terms of by clinician, even if it's mixed in all kinds of odd ways, it would certainly help the clinic to know who's the, you know, using the most or the least, and whatever you have, that could be private perhaps, but I think we absolutely have to let individuals know how they're going to behave. And if it's true that if you tell a clinician that he's way high or way low on cost or quality, whatever, that they're going to change your behavior, that would be a nice way to start, so they could even begin to do the behaviors that will be more reflective of their peer group. So that's just an encouragement for you. Thanks.
Dr. Golden.
Madam Chair, committee members, I think a good little graphic of what we are trying to pull together and where some of the data is coming from can be seen from this, the sources, data sources. The quality measures are coming from a variety of spots. There have been a variety of community efforts that were going on with Minnesota Community Measurement that the community was working on. We have supplemented those both with financial support as well as bringing that into our activities and working collaboratively with them. Hospital Compare is a federal effort that looks at a variety of quality measures that is required by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. We have tried to build upon that so as to minimize the burden to our hospital community. And then there are HEDIS measures, which ultimately come from the plans but are done in conjunction with the medical groups that are out there. We have also incorporated new measures into it, looking at health information technologies. How are they using those technologies, and how are those delivering care? We have built on some of the work at ICSI around depression. We are continuing to have discussions with community measurement and others around patient experience. And then looking at how the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, how some of their measures are incorporating. When it comes to quality, we have a strong preference for getting the information directly from the clinicians, from the clinics and the hospitals. So that's why you see at the bottom, the bulk of the quality stuff is coming directly from the healthcare providers. That helps to eliminate a lot of the questions with the data and some of the concerns. Mm-hmm. On the other side, the cost data, really that is coming from health plans and third-party administrators. What this is de-identified healthcare claim data, where we take claim data and we encrypt a variety of information at the health plan or at the third-party administrator so that we can link the data across the various sources, but that it is not individually identifiable data. And from that, we are able to look at both the utilization and the dollars flowing throughout the system on the cost. Additionally, there are a variety of ways that this data can be quite helpful in looking at things such as hospital readmission, and some of the hospital avoidance where people end up in the hospital because they weren't getting adequate care in a clinic or primary care setting. The cost data that we have in Minnesota is the most complete in the country. We are the only state in the country that has Medicare, Medicaid, as well as private data. And so from that standpoint, our data source for this is quite good, and we think that that should provide some comfort in appreciating the reliability and validity of the results.
Dr. Gold, I'm really sorry, but we've got only a few minutes left, and you have a lot of slides. I think some of these things, maybe you can move through some of them and allow us to read them, and maybe your comments where it may not be written down on a slide.
Absolutely. Madam Chair, what you see here are the time frame of what we are anticipating. Again, it's when it goes to the hospitals for their review, when it goes to the clinics for their review, and then when the information is anticipated to be publicly available. I would say that the goal for having information publicly available is at the end of this calendar year. We would hope to have this available in time for the open enrollment periods that you frequently see at the end of the calendar year. Again, thinking about consumers and how they might want to be able to use this data and thinking about their clinic and hospital choices. The law does require others to use the data. So there are a variety of payers that are required to use the data. The state employee group is required to use it to supplement their information to state employees. Political subdivisions that might be self-funded are required to include it in their activities. All health plan companies are required to use this, including those in the individual and small market, as well as our sister agency, DHS, is required to think about how provider peer grouping might be able to inform some of their decisions as well. Most of these organizations are required to begin using the data 12 months after it is publicly available. Again, thinking about some of the methodologies and how we got there, one of our big things is to make sure we're cooperating and collaborating with all of the various stakeholders. This started in 2009 when we first started implementing, and this is where we really got the framework for what we're trying to implement. In 2010, we implemented a contract with Mathematica Policy Research to help with doing the actual on-the-ground analyses and analytic work. In May 2010, we decided that there were going to be a variety of issues that needed some oversight and some looking at, and so we developed a rapid response team that is made up of the physician community, the hospital community, human services, employers, as well as consumers. And this is really to provide input on very specific issues. Starting in December, we had the first meeting of a reliability work group, which is primarily payers and providers, looking at how do we know that what comes out at the end is going to meet their needs and be helpful for their activities. And then one thing that we do on an ongoing basis to keep everybody up to speed is we have a monthly conference call at 7:30 in the morning. And the reason that we do it quite that early is to make sure that practicing physicians and others who might be interested have the opportunity to participate.
Dr. Golden, I think that's helpful. Why don't you just take the first slide of your next presentation and talk about where we get our health coverage from? And I think then we're going to slide two of this part. Go one more slide up. And just for the sake of it, the big picture, and then we'll have to call it a day on this presentation. And because we're going to move to the exchange, and this whole health economics discussion is fascinating, and maybe we can have a whole day about that sometime. And when you hit, if there's a little lull time or we're in between bills, and it's very important work, but a lot of it's self-explanatory. But if you want to tell us at least the first slide, then we'll move into our insurance exchange discussion.
Mr. Chair, I would be more than happy to. Maybe as a precursor to this slide, it would be helpful just to mention, I know that you have heard a lot in this committee about data that is collected by a variety of agencies and for a variety of purposes. I can't speak for everybody, but within the Department of Health, one of the major sources of information that we have is our health economics program. It tends to collect information quite a lot about where people are getting their insurance from, where dollars are coming into the state, where they're flowing, and we tend to really monitor the markets around healthcare. And so there are a lot of slides here with a lot of data. We tried to pick some slides in this packet that were related to activities and discussions that you've been having both in this committee and Representative Gottwaltz. And so we would be more than happy to come back and let you know what we have and how those might impact and relate to some of the questions that you have. What you have on this slide, Mr. Chair, that you had specifically asked about is where are people getting their health insurance coverage? The Health Economics Program does a survey every other year that takes a look at this. The last most recent was in 2009. So we know we have about 5.3 million people in Minnesota. Approximately 64% of those are getting their insurance through the private healthcare market. About 38.4% of the people are self-insured, meaning that they are outside of the state regulations that we would have, whereas about 25.3% are fully insured. You have within the public programs, medical assistance, GAMC, and MinCare, approximately 12% of our population. About 14.7% is in Medicare. About 0.5% is in MSHA, the high-risk pool. And our most current estimates show that approximately 9% of the population is uninsured. And although I won't talk about it, the very next slide actually shows how those numbers have moved around between 1999 and 2009.
I think that's very helpful. If anybody has a question, we can take one. Otherwise, we're going to move on to the insurance exchange. Seeing none, thanks, Dr. Golden, for that. And for members, while you're, if you want to come down, Ms. Todd Watlov. And, are you coming to Mr. Monsignor Gala, or are you going to watch there? Okay. Or Todd Malmoff, sorry. If you look at our part of the world is this 12% MAG, AMC, Minnesota care. That's kind of how we spend a lot of our time talking about things. If you notice, when you have a mandate to improve somebody's coverage, it only covers 25% of the market now, which has been sliding to a lower number. In the self-insured market, which is the ERISA market, is pushing 40%. So we can't tell them to do anything. So that's a discussion about that. Welcome to the committee. And before you get going, I want to just, Mr. Munson-Nergal is moving on to, I don't know where, but he's been, for the new members, he's been a real asset at the department. And they're seeking for somebody as good as him, and they'll have a hard time replacing him. So he's been a good state employee to look after the various concerns. He's been to our committees many times, and I he may come back as somebody we'll see again at the witness table. But thanks again for your service to the state. It's been a good one. So we're going to talk about the exchange now, and we have about 35 minutes to do this. Then we're going to do a health demonstration here. So welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and tell us all about it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is April Todd Malmlove, and I'm the Health Insurance Exchange Director for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I also serve as the State Health Economist for the Department of Health. So what I'll go over today are three key issues related to the exchange. First, just a general explanation of what an exchange is. Second, talk about what the components of the exchange are, the requirements and options under those components. And specifically mention that the exchange in each state must be operational by January 1st of 2014 under the federal law. And so an important point to point out there is that if a state does not establish one, the federal government will establish one on the state's behalf to operate in a state. And then lastly, we'll describe the planning grant that we just applied for on February 1st. So an overview, what is an exchange? Generally, an exchange is an organized competitive marketplace, kind of a one-stop shop to facilitate and simplify the comparison, choice, enrollment, and purchase of healthcare coverage for individual consumers. And individual consumers is the key point here to mention in regards to the exchange. Now, the diagram that you see here on the slide is a representation of all of the different stakeholders that are involved in the operation of an exchange. So first, to start out, an exchange will be working with a variety of different data sources and need to interact with a variety of different agencies, including the Department of Commerce, the Department of Health, Department of Human Services, and the federal IRS or the Revenue Department. And what the exchange will be doing is operating with those entities to share and collect information to determine what type of health plans will be offered in the exchange, connection to Medicaid for Medicaid enrollees that will also be going through the exchange, collecting information on cost and quality and using that information that would be going through the Department of Health, and also sharing tax-related information with the Department of Revenue as well. So there's a lot of back-end functions that happen with the exchange. So outside of those back-end functions that the exchange will be doing, there's a lot of interaction that will occur among individuals, employers, employees, health plans, and navigators. So I'll walk you through just generally how an individual would interact with the exchange. So an individual goes to the exchange, a web-based type of format, log on, get onto the exchange, put in this is my zip code, this is my age, this is how much money I make, that type of information. That information goes into the exchange. The exchange, in a real-time back-end office kind of format, uses that information to determine what type of coverage that individual would be eligible for. They may be eligible for Medicaid. They may be eligible for subsidized coverage. They may not be eligible for subsidized coverage at all, but coverage may vary depending on what zip code that they live in. And so it will show them what the different options are that are available to them, and provide them information to help them make the best choice for them. For example, information on quality, information on cost, information on the types of benefits that are in the plan, and the types of network providers that are also available through that plan. Now, to help an individual choose the type of plan that they would like, they could have the assistance of someone called a navigator. And what a navigator is under the federal law could be a variety of different organizations. Can include a broker, could include a chamber of commerce, a consumer advocacy organization, that type of mechanism to help an individual navigate through their choices that are in the exchange. So once an individual chooses the coverage that is best for them and their family, that information is communicated to the health plan, and that individual is automatically enrolled. It's a real-time enrollment that happens at the time that that decision is made. Now, for employers and employees, the mechanism is very similar, but with one very distinct difference. And that difference is that the employer will set aside a certain amount of money, or what's called a defined contribution, and that the employees use that money to pick the plan that is best for them. So as opposed to in the market today, where the small employer picks the plan for all of their employees, the individual employee would be able to choose what plan it is that's best for them and use the employer contribution to offset the cost of that plan for that employee. So now that I've given you a little bit of background on what an exchange is, why do you do an exchange? What's the reason for doing it? An exchange is there to foster a more competitive marketplace and make it more simplified for consumers to access healthcare coverage, create greater incentives for market competition on quality and cost. And it does this by addressing some of the barriers to competition that exist in the healthcare market today. First, it provides transparent comparative information for individuals. So today, information on prices and cost, quality benefits, and network provider information is often hard to find, especially in one place that's easy for consumers to find. So this puts this in one place, a one-stop shop, makes it simple for consumers to find that information and compare that information. Second, it's designed to engage consumers. As I was describing, most consumers today get their coverage through an employer, so they're not responsible for the insurance choice or the cost. And so in an exchange, individuals and employees are responsible for the coverage choice that they make and responsible for that price differential that is between the amount that they pay and the employer-defined contribution or the subsidy level that they would get. Third, it also facilitates mobility and portability. So again, consumers today are not really free to change or maintain a plan that they like or dislike. When their employer changes their plan, they go with where that employer plan is. And so the exchange allows consumers to change or maintain the plans that they like or dislike and still keep the tax benefits of employer-based coverage. And then lastly, an exchange can increase the number of sellers in a market. So in most insurance markets, there are very few sellers that are there, so little competition. What the exchange does is it reduces some of the barriers to entry for new plans, and they do this by offering a large pool of potential enrollees without requiring some of the upfront costs and time associated with marketing and sales and enrollment. So it makes that easier for new plans to enter the market. So now I'm going to talk about different components of the exchange. There, you can generally bucket the components or requirements and options of an exchange into eight categories, the first of which is functions. The exchange under the federal law is required to do a minimum level of functions, and the list that is here are the requirements that the exchange must do as a function. First, it needs to certify which insurers and benefit plans are qualified for participation. And what I should mention here is that the exchange is responsible for ensuring that these functions get performed, but the exchange does not necessarily need to perform these functions on its own. It can contract these functions out. It can have agreements with state agencies to also perform these functions. So it just needs to ensure that the functions are done, but it does not necessarily need to perform them on its own. So in addition to certifying insurers and benefit plans, it also needs to operate a toll-free hotline and website for providing information. It will be required to provide standardized comparative information on insurers and benefit plans. And that standardized information must include information on cost, quality, and customer satisfaction. We'll also be required to set up an open enrollment and special enrollment period. So one time a year, there will be an open enrollment period. And then similar to how it operates today for employers, there will be special enrollment periods as well. For example, when someone has a child or when they get married, those types of events. We'll also be required to determine eligibility for individual and employer subsidies, which we'll describe a little bit later what those subsidy amounts are. It will also be determining eligibility for Medicaid, and if it finds that someone is eligible for Medicaid, facilitate enrollment for that person into Medicaid. And when it facilitates eligibility and enrollment, it must use a uniform format, and it must be in real time. So the guidance that we got from HHS in November said that no matter what the person is eligible for, if they are eligible for Medicaid, if they're eligible for subsidies, or if they're not eligible for subsidies, they must be treated in exactly the same fashion when they enter the exchange, and so that everyone has the same experience when they enter. It also must make an electronic calculator available to display the cost of coverage. So what is the expected cost of coverage for an individual once you take into account the subsidies that are available? It also will be required to communicate with employers regarding potential employee subsidy eligibility, if the employee cancels coverage, and free choice vouchers. And what free choice vouchers are is, under the law, if an employee has a premium through an employer, and that premium is between 8 and 9.5% of an employee's income, that employer must contribute the cost that they would have contributed towards employer-based coverage and allow that employee to take that money into the exchange and pick the plan it is that they would choose to enroll in. And so that's one function that the exchange must communicate with employers on, that particular aspect. The exchange must also use an electronic interchange to share information with various state and federal agencies to determine eligibility, the amount of subsidies, and to determine exemptions from the individual coverage requirement. And lastly, the exchange is required to establish a navigator program. And as I was explaining before, what a navigator program is it can be a variety of different entities designed to help individuals with enrollment, with grievances that they have. So similar to the functions today that brokers do, that a chamber of commerce could do, consumer advocacy organizations, those types of things. So the federal law will be prescribing minimum requirements for navigators, but the exchange itself will be setting up that program, determining what the compensation is and those types of aspects. One requirement that does exist under the navigator program that is particularly important to point out is that a navigator operating through the exchange cannot get compensated through a health plan for enrollment through the exchange. The exchange would be the one providing the compensation to the navigator. And so that is a different relationship than what exists today between brokers and health plans.
Thank you, Ms. Todd Malmoth, Representative Gotwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually going to wait until she was done with her presentation, but as long as you're giving me the floor. Perhaps you could speak, testifier, to the fact, to what in here is not currently already being performed by the marketplace. I think you've touched on a couple of them, but I think that's the question I get asked most, is why do we need this? We're already doing it.
Ms. Todd Malmoth.
What the exchange does that doesn't exist in the market today is it provides a one-stop simplified shop for consumers to find information, for one, and two, it facilitates a defined contribution type arrangement in the market, and so that employees can make that choice from the plan that best suits them, as opposed to in an employer-based type environment, and it facilitates some of that portability that exists today. So, for example, it's similar to the transition that is still being made but started a while ago to move from pension plans to 401k-type plans. And so it's that same transition, similar type of mechanism.
Epson Gotwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I don't want to get into too much of a debate here, but I think there are people who would argue that many of these options are being provided in kind of uniform ways in the marketplace right now, including, you know, clearinghouses, one-stop shop places to check benefits and costs. I'm sure many agents who spend their whole life trying to help people find appropriate health care coverage would say that they function much as navigators and as clearinghouses for these things. So I'm trying to identify where the unique quality or advance or benefit is coming from as we develop these. And I realize we don't want to, I'd like to hear the rest of the presentation too, but that's clearly a line of discussion.
I think we'll just take that as an open question. Maybe you can just answer a question for me. The navigator getting paid right now, they get paid from the health plan. So since the plans have to be the same price outside as inside the exchange if they're offered in both places, how are most states going to handle paying the agent who's using an exchange to find their client some product?
Mr. Chair, states are looking at a variety of different funding mechanisms for the exchange. One of the things that is being considered by many states is a fee on the health plans that would be used to fund the exchange, and that component would also be used to fund the portion of the navigator fee as well. And so you would still have premiums the same inside and outside, total premiums, but that portion that comes from the health plan would be a transfer of funds between the two.
And so are they charging ERISA plans or just their state fully insured plans that we can do whatever we want to?
Mr. Chair, I would say that there's a variety of mechanisms that the state is considering for funding, and again, some states are just in the very early stages of what they're considering in terms of funding some of these things.
And the thought of adding more cost to our system really makes me nervous, but I'm just asking these questions. So are we allowed to charge? Could we charge our whole insurance market in Minnesota? Could we charge an ERISA plan know, some tiny fraction of a percent to get enough money to run this thing? Or do we have to just use ones that we can regulate as a state to get money from?
Mr. Chair, the same rules that apply today would also apply in 2014 regarding your ability to charge fees to those types of organizations. So, for example, things that we have in the state today, like the provider tax, that are applied broadly would still be a functional financing mechanism. But, again, the rules would apply the same in the
we couldn't
they do today.
Charge ERISA 1/1,000,000th of a percent, for instance. And so they're going to, okay, we have. I have so many questions. Well, just with somebody else a question, we'll just keep on going. So thanks.
All right. So another component of the exchange is around eligibility. So who is eligible to participate in the exchange? Individuals are eligible to participate. Small groups are also eligible to participate. And there's a choice here for the state to make regarding eligibility of small groups. In 2016, small group will be defined as 1 to 100 employees. The state has the ability from 2014 to 2016 to limit eligibility for small groups from 1 to 50 employees. And so that's a state option that the state can to use is for those 2 years to limit it to 50. The key difference here to point out is that the definition of small group will be size 1 to either 50 or 100. And that is different from what we have in the market today where it's 2 to 50. So those people that are self-employed could be counted as small employers. Now, certain small employers through the exchange will be eligible for tax credits. And these are sliding scale through the exchange for up to 2 years for up to 50% of the employer's premium portion for those that have less than 25 employees and less than a $50,000 average wage. Large groups may also be able to participate, but only in the future and at the state's discretion. And so that's in 2017, the state may allow large groups to participate, and they may determine at what level large groups could participate. So they can set it at 200 employees, they could set it at 500 employees. It's at the state's discretion. Related to eligibility, as I already mentioned, the exchange must also determine eligibility for Medicaid and for tax subsidies. Under the law, there are subsidies for individual coverage, and these are only available through the exchange for those individuals that are not eligible for affordable employer-based coverage. And what the subsidies do is that they limit the cost of a silver-based plan, which is a medium-type-based plan in the exchange, to premiums. They limit the premiums to between 2% and 9.5% of an individual's income. And there are also subsidies for cost-sharing that limit actuarial value to 94%, range from 94% to 70%. And what actuarial value means is it's the percent of the costs for the plan that are paid for by the enrollee versus the plan. Also related to eligibility, there's another option for the state in here as well, and this is the basic health plan. So the state can establish a basic health plan for those individuals that are between 133 and 200% of the federal poverty level. And how this works is that states can get 95% of those individual subsidy funds, both the premium subsidies and the cost-sharing subsidies. And they can use that money to provide coverage for individuals between 133 and 200% of poverty level. And the basic health plan is envisioned to operate very similarly to how we operate Minnesota Care today, in that it is a negotiation between private health plans, where private health plans would be providing that. The one thing to point out here regarding the basic health plan is that if a state does this, individuals between 133 and 200 must get coverage through the basic health plan. They cannot choose to get coverage through a subsidized plan, a private subsidized plan through the exchange. So they must go through the basic health plan. The third component related to the exchange is regarding health plan certification. And so HHS is going to be establishing minimum criteria for health plans to participate in the exchange. And the law specifically lists these following things that are required for a health plan to participate in the exchange. They must comply with marketing requirements that are established, network adequacy provisions, so which type of providers need to be in the network. They need to be accredited on a variety of local clinical quality measures, patient experience, consumer access, utilization management, patient information systems, those types of things. They also must disclose a variety of components of information on claims payment policies, rating practices, denials, that type of information. Must have a plan in place for implementing a quality improvement strategy. Agree to use that standardized format for comparing health plans that the exchange sets up. also agree to utilize the uniform enrollment form and process that the exchange sets up, and agree to offer at least one silver and one gold plan in the exchange. And what silver and gold and platinum and all those types of plans are is an actuarial value level in the exchange. And we'll describe that on the next page, what that means. A fourth component of the exchange is related to market rules, and these are the rules that apply inside and outside the exchange as they're specified in the law. So there are benefit, rating, and guarantee issue rules that are in the exchange and in the outside market. So they apply to both individual and small group plans, both inside and outside the exchange, but not to grandfathered plans. And what grandfathered plans are generally, if a person has a plan today that they like, they can keep that. They don't need to change that. And so these rules don't apply to those. But in terms of benefit rules, both inside and outside the exchange, for the individual and the small group market, HHS will be establishing an essential benefit set or a minimum benefit set. And that is defined as bronze. And that is at a 60% actuarial value level. So that means 60% of the plan costs are paid by the plan and 40% is paid by the enrollee. There are other levels above that as well. So there's silver, gold, platinum, and a young invincible type plan for those under the age of 30. And silver is a 70% actuarial value, gold is 80% actuarial value, platinum is 90% actuarial value, and the Young Invincible plan is roughly a 50% actuarial value catastrophic type plan with preventive benefits provided on the front end. There are also rating and issue rules that will apply to individual and small group plans inside and outside the exchange. And what this means is that premium variation based on health status will not be allowed. And rating variation will only be limited to tobacco use, age, geography, which is state-defined, and family composition. And guarantee issue will be required during an open enrollment period. So anyone that comes to a plan wishing to get coverage must be accepted. They can't be denied. Other rules that are in the exchange is that premiums for the same plans inside and outside the exchange must be the same, but the same plans don't need to be offered inside and outside the exchange. So this is another option as well where the state can require that the same plans be inside and outside the exchange, but the federal law does not. Certification rules, so those rules I was describing earlier that plans needed to comply with to participate in the exchange, they only apply to the exchange. They don't apply to the outside market, things around network adequacy, marketing, those types of things. But this is an option here, too, where the state can require that those certification rules apply inside and outside as well. And lastly, under the law, there are wellness discounts under market rules. And this is a 10-state demonstration project that would allow wellness discounts that are currently available in the group market to be applied to the individual market for premium and cost-sharing subsidies. So essentially, you get a 20% discount either through your premiums or your cost-sharing for engaging in healthy behavior, reducing smoking, reducing your weight, complying with drug regimens, those types of things. Another component in the law is related to risk-sharing.
Representative, help me.
Yes.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Mamlov, going back up to the guaranteed issue required during the open enrollment period, is there going to be a specific open enrollment period, or is it going to be throughout the year? Because that has led to some serious problems already.
Ms. Todd Mamlov.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, we don't yet have guidance on what the open enrollment provision means. If you assume that it is the same definition as open enrollment generally means, it would mean a one time of year type of open enrollment, or could mean a couple of different times during the year. But again, we don't have guidance from HHS yet as to what exactly that means.
Details to follow. Keep going.
All right.
Thanks.
So the other component in the exchange is related to risk sharing. And there are a variety of different risk sharing provisions that are in the law. The first two are temporary in nature, and they are to deal with some of the changes that will happen over the first few years regarding the changes in guarantee issue and the rating rules that will change. And so it's to shift funds between plans if certain plans get more high-risk individuals than others, to try to equalize that out. And the first is reinsurance, and how the reinsurance works is that $25 billion will be collected from fully self-insured plans, and that money would be distributed to plans in the individual market that attract a higher risk population than other plans. In each individual state, they can choose the reinsurer, and that reinsurer can be the high-risk pool. So in Minnesota, for example, MSHA could be that high-risk pool. The second thing is risk corridors, and the risk corridors will be used for the individual and the small group plans inside and outside the exchange, and they'll operate similar to how the Part D program works. And so what that means is that they will compare the plan's claims to their premium volume and see what the differential there is, and if they are losing money or gaining money, they would either pay in or receive money back through that risk corridor program. Third, there will be a risk adjustment system that will be set up, and this will be permanent. And this is where HHS will be working with states to develop the criteria and the methods for risk adjustment for individual and small group plans inside and outside the exchange. This is an area where Minnesota could be well ahead of the game compared to some other states in terms of what we could use for risk adjustment. We are one of a few states that has an all-payer claims database that could be used for risk adjustment, so that we can actually be incenting plans to want to enroll and effectively manage the care of high-risk individuals, because we have that detailed information that could allow plan payments to be accurately given to the plans to manage that care. There's also provision around risk pooling, and what this means is that plans that are inside and outside the exchange would be in the same risk pool. And then there is a separate component as well under the law that allows states to merge their individual and their small group markets if they so choose. One thing to point out related to the exchange is an issue that many people are raising that is an important issue to consider when you're establishing or thinking of establishing an exchange, and that is related to adverse selection. And adverse selection, generally what that means is it's the unequal separation of risk into different insurance arrangements. And the reason why it's an issue for the exchange is that if you have market rules and characteristics of products that are different inside and outside a market or pool, it could lead to separation of risk. And when that happens, you can have higher risk individuals, higher premiums, and resulting lower enrollment inside versus outside a market or a pool. And when that continues over time, you get a death spiral. So higher and higher premiums, lower and lower enrollment, and the pool eventually dies and doesn't function well. And we actually have quite a few examples of this that have existed in the U.S. Through purchasing pools that were enacted by many states in the early 1990s. In effect, we had one in Minnesota here, the MEAT program that was started and failed as well. And the reason for that is that you had voluntary participation by individuals and employers, similar to what you will have under the exchange, and different market rules and products inside and outside. So you're attracting different types of risk inside and outside the exchange. And so what the federal law does to mitigate this is a few provisions are included in the law to do that. First is the single risk pool inside and outside. It establishes a minimum benefit level that applies inside and outside, that essential benefit set. As I was explaining before, it applies the same rating rules inside and outside the exchange as well. The risk adjustment provisions will also help to mitigate that. And the subsidies that are available in the exchange will also serve to attract people into the exchange and keep a pool in the exchange. However, there are still some adverse selection concerns to consider as well. When there are different insurers and different products that operate inside and outside the exchange, you could have a separation of risk there in terms of certain insurers. For example, you could have an insurer that had one subsidiary operating inside the exchange and one operating outside of the exchange, and they would be able to split their risk pools. Also, another issue of concern is when there are different market rules that exist inside and outside the exchange, for example, related to certification or network adequacy. So if you have different rules regarding which providers or how extensive the network is inside or outside the exchange, that could have an impact on which type of people are attracted inside and outside as well. Okay, so the last three components of an exchange to consider are around governance, structure, and financing. And so under the law, there are some options for governance. It can be set up as a government entity, as a nonprofit established by the state, or would be done by the federal government on behalf of the state. In terms of structure, you can set it up as a combined or separate exchange for individuals and small employers. You can establish multiple subsidiary exchanges, each serving a distinct geographic area, or establish a regional exchange that would include multiple states. And so those are the options that are there for structure. And then around financing, on the financing end, HHS is going to be fully funding states for exchange startup through 2014. But starting in 2015, the exchange must be self-sustaining.
Oh, Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. What do they mean by fully funding? That is a question that I've had. I know we've applied for a $1 million grant to help with startup, but or actually to help with planning, but What does the federal government mean by fully funding for the exchange startup through 2014? Is that whatever it costs us? Is it a blank check?
Ms. Todd Mama.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald. What that means is that the planning grant, and I'll explain that a little bit later too in more details. What the planning grant is for is the planning grant is to analyze the different requirements and options that are in the exchange, and to also for those states that will be establishing an exchange to develop a justifiable budget. And so the key word there is justifiable. So you have to be able to prove what it is you would need the money for HHS to approve that. So you can't just ask for as much money as you want. You need to be able to justify how that money will be used to satisfy the requirements under the exchange and the options with which the state chooses to implement.
Yeah, we're down to like 6 minutes, so we're doing this next hour or two, Representative Gottwald. Yeah, I know how many questions you have. Representative Franson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Todd, self-sustaining, I just want to make it a point that we can't even sustain our government right now. We are $6.2 billion in the hole. And so where is HHS? Is this grant coming from the federal government, the $1 billion, and what happens when that is done and we can't sustain the exchange?
Ms. Todd Mama.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the $1 million is for the planning grant for planning, and there will be implementation funds for implementation. What self-sustaining means is that the state or the exchange would need to find a funding source to fund the ongoing operations of the exchange. That can take a variety of different forms. HHS has not specified what format that funding would need to take.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Todd, what happens, though, if the exchange cannot be funded?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the funding streams that could potentially operate through the exchange don't necessarily have to be state funding streams. And so the exchange can establish its own funding mechanisms. That answers your question.
Representative Franz, we'll be talking about this some more. So this is kind of the overview part, and not to press you, but why don't you just get through the material, and then this is a good first pass. And there'll be more bites at this, and bills pending, and you'll be back again, and you're around to talk to. So I appreciate the updates you're giving us. So continue.
Yep. So there are a variety of key decision points here to consider regarding the exchange. The first is how should the exchange be operated and structured? Second is should Minnesota migrate Minnesota Care to the basic health plan or facilitate subsidies for private market coverage through the exchange? Third is how to reduce the risk of adverse selection and encourage value and competition in the market. And here is a key question for Minnesota is how can we use Minnesota's unique cost, quality, and payment reforms to drive insurer and provider competition on value and empower consumers to make more informed healthcare decisions and improve their health. And so there's a key thing here that Minnesota has some unique information and some unique data that could be applied to the exchange to make this work more effectively. Next, how to incent competition for and care management and coordination of high-risk individuals and encourage healthy behavior. A question around should the risk pools for the individual and small group markets be merged? What should the navigator requirements and compensation look like? And how should the ongoing operations of the exchange be funded? So those are some of the key decision points that are there.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Todd Munloff, amongst Minnesota's unique cost, quality, and payment reforms are the things that we passed in 2008, like bundles, healthcare homes, chronic disease management, pay for performance. Is there any prohibition? We mandated that insurance companies had to offer at least one policy that had those things in it. Is there anything in the federal law that would prevent us from mandating the same things inside the exchange?
Ms. Todd Mullen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, there's no prohibition. There's actually a section in the law that encourages states to develop mechanisms to encourage market-based incentives for quality and for improving and doing payment reform. For example, I'll give you an example of how potentially PPG could be used in the exchange. If you had an individual, for example, that was a diabetic, you could set up your exchange to when that person entered the exchange and they put in their zip code and they put in their income and their age, could also provide an opportunity for them to say, I'm a diabetic. And they can search for search for show me the best clinics to go to care for my diabetic care. And it could find those clinics and connect those clinics up to the health plans that are offered that have that clinic in their network and what the cost sharing would be for those clinics. And so it would help that person find the best place for their care by incorporating quality and cost information for clinics and providers and for the health plans.
So I'll keep going and I just finish.
So just a few more slides. And one thing to point out here just regarding timeline of how this works is that, as mentioned before, coverage to the exchange is required in January 1st of 2014. Either the state sets that up or it will be implemented by the federal government. So if you step back and figure out how the timeline works from that perspective, that essentially means that in fall of 2013 is the open enrollment period. Summer of 2013 is when the exchange would populate information on health plan products and ratings and those types of things. On January 1st of 2013, in the law, it states that the state must prove to HHS that the exchange can be operational by January 1st of 2014, or HHS will implement. So that January 1st of 2013 date is actually a very important date before January 1st of 2014, because the state has to prove that it could have something operational in a year. So that means from the date that we have today in 2011 through January 1st of 2013, this is the time frame to evaluate the exchange requirements and options and make some significant progress on implementation. So that essentially means most of those key questions that were on the prior page need to be answered, and significant progress be made on the IT component of this with the electronic interchanges that need to be developed between a variety of agents, state and federal agencies. And so that leaves us at 2011 with the receipt of the exchange planning grant funding. And just briefly, we'll kind of describe what the planning grant is that we applied for. So we applied for a $1 million planning grant on February 1st. And we are expecting award notification from HHS by March 1st of this year. No state match is required for this funding. And what the purpose of the planning grant is to analyze the impact of exchange requirements and options, to estimate the upfront and ongoing funding that would be needed for implementation and operation, to use that information to determine whether the state will establish an exchange or defer to the federal government, and then if the state decides to establish an exchange, to develop a work plan and a justifiable budget for federal implementation funds to implement the exchange. And so there are a variety of components that were required in the exchange grant for the state to address, and there are 9 areas around background research, stakeholder engagement, program integration, resources and capabilities, governance, financing, technical infrastructure, business operations, and legal and regulatory issues. And so the key components that were in the exchange application that we submitted were first around, we were doing some actuarial and economic modeling to answer some questions around the size of the small group market, whether to merge the markets, whether to allow large employers into the markets, those types of questions. Some work that we'll be doing with to engage stakeholders on thoughts around requirements and options for the exchange. Looking at the different programs that we have within the state, both the Medicaid program, regulatory things that we do, the cost and quality data that we have, how to integrate that, how that could be worked with the IT system, and what are the options for doing that. And also looking at business operations and what are the different options and costs of business operations that the exchange would need to perform. So we were looking at those types of things planning for the planning grant.
Well, thanks. And this is a good start. This is quite a large topic, and we meant to be at an overview level, which I think we've accomplished that. There'll be more discussion in the Reform Committee. Do you just want to comment on, you have a sub-cabinet that's kind of looking after this between the 3 departments and you and Ms. Gilchrist? Do you want to just mention that for people?
Sure. There's a health reform sub-cabinet that includes the departments of Commerce, Health, Human Services, and Management and Budget. And we have staff throughout all of those agencies working on a variety of different, analyzing a variety of different health reform issues. There's specifically a exchange group that has staff that will be working under the planning grant to evaluate some of the requirements and options that are available under the exchange.
And do you have a time frame for what's going to come out of that group for scheduling? Is that going to be done by March? Do you have a proposal coming, do you think, or before or after that?
Mr. Chair, one of the key components of trying to figure out what the cost would be for the exchanges around the IT component and the program integration, and that will be a component that will take quite a few months to get through. And so we're anticipating by the end of this calendar year to have some significant work done related to the planning grant.
But you need some legislation, is that right? Or do you not need legislation to proceed?
Mr. Chair, under the planning grant, this is evaluation and analysis of different options that could be under that, and so we are analyzing what the effect of different options are and what the cost of different options could be, and so that's the purpose of the planning grant.
Okay. So now that gets the last question, then we're going to turn you loose. Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair and Ms. Todd, Momlove, could you just give an example? Let's say there's a company that's got 50 employees. They provide health insurance to them, and 25% of their employees or a quarter of their employees are eligible for a subsidy. What are their options? Do they have to move all their employees into the, or do they keep them separate? How do they work that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, I think the key question there would be whether or not the employer is subsidizing the coverage or not, whether they're providing a contribution. If the employer is providing a contribution in the exchange, the employees of that employer would not be eligible for the subsidies. So the only individuals that are eligible for subsidies are those that don't have access to affordable employer-based coverage, and that's an 8% of income standard. And so it's a crowd-out provision to to keep employers offering coverage. However, if they aren't offering coverage, essentially they would be going in as individuals and finding the plan that best meets their needs and their family's needs.
Ms. Tennyson, why don't you just come down and start getting set up? We have one more question. So once you get your apparatus going and hook up your client here, there's one more question. Representative McDonald has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Todd, just a question on the timeline, the last slide. It says on bullet number, I think it's the third one in the timeline, January 1st, 2013, says the state must prove to HHS that exchange can be operational by January 1st of 2014, or HHS will implement federal exchange. Does that mean the state legislature is not needed in implementing this, and it comes solely from HHS?
Ms. Todd.
Mr. Chair, Representative. What the January 2013 date is an assessment by HHS as to whether or not the state is would be able to have one operational by 2014. And one of the requirements of that is that the exchange and the state has the authority to implement. And so that's one of the provisions that's in that requirement.
Representative McDonald.
So just to clarify, is that a misprint or is that? Shouldn't be the state legislature that can implement federal
level.
The federal exchange?
Ms. Todd Mama.
Chair Representative, this is just a broad statement to just say that there are a variety of things that the state and the exchange would need to prove that it would be ready to accomplish. One of them is authority. The other is, you know, has it progressed far enough along in the IT development? It's a variety of different components that it would need to justify whether it's ready.
Mr. Chairman, just lastly, I would just change that to the state legislature then should implement the federal exchange, not the HHS. That's my little editorial. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think we'll have many more discussions about this to come. Thanks for coming down and welcome to your position. And thank you. So, Mr. Tennyson, we're moving to a whole different thing here. I'm trying to pack a lot in, and tomorrow, just for the sake of the public, we're taking up the DHS budget, and then Thursday we're doing the Department of Health budget. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Tennyson. I'm attorney in Minneapolis, and I'm only here to introduce Dr. Randy Moore, who's the president and CEO of American Telecare, Inc. They're going to do a demonstration of telemedicine between a clinic and a home, so you get a firsthand feel of how this works, and Dr. Moore is a graduate of Wabash College in Indiana. He did his medical school at Johns Hopkins in Washington, D.C., his residency in Minnesota in internal medicine and emergency care, specialist specializing in chronic illness, and he also has an MBA from the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University, Dr. Moore. Also, Larry Diamond will be helping, and we've asked for a guinea pig here, and Mr. Huntley, Representative Huntley, has agreed to be the.
Thank you, Mr. Tennyson, and Mr. Diamond. Appears as though you need a few moments to get everything set up. So my understanding is the purpose of your demonstration today is telehealth demonstration.
Yes, thank you, members of the committee. Again, I'm Randy Moore, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. Aside from the demonstration, I'd like to put it into some context. What I'd like to do is give you a brief history of 30 years of evolution and what this means from a personal and professional level. What I hope can come out of these few minutes is to challenge you to think in a different way. Almost as happened to me about 8-9 years ago, one of those moments where everything you'd worked for and everything you'd believed about how medicine worked and what quality health care meant and the value that could be delivered was kind of flipped over on its side. It was also one of saying a realization that we may have the answer right in front of us where we may see we have a problem. So let me go backwards 30 years. I grew up in Gary, Indiana. My whole family was in the steel industry, the other end of the mines. And I was talking to my grandfather as I was coming home from medical school in Baltimore. And my grandfather was suffering from chronic heart disease. And one of the things he shared with me 30 years ago that impacted me was saying he thought the cost of health care was becoming astronomical 30 years ago. And he did not think it was sustainable, and he did not feel he could continue to live. And 1 week later, he died. And I've learned through my career in medicine, when people give up the will to live, they die. Fast forward 30 years. I came to Minnesota to practice medicine because I saw the HMO movement. I saw an opportunity to learn about how to integrate the cost of care with the quality of care. I came here. What I largely learned about was not managing care. It was an attempt to manage cost. Care was secondary. Fast forward to this year. After a 4-year struggle with cirrhosis from hepatitis C and cancer related, my mom passed away. We had 8 kids in the family. Out of the kids and the siblings, we have 5 nurses and 3 doctors. Mom got a fair amount of personal care. You can imagine. I got to see the best and the worst. We had a couple of fantastic physicians, some home care, all the resources healthcare could throw at mom. And she had a very doting, caring family, maybe a little more educated in healthcare than the average family. And I watched a lot of things go wrong. Not because we didn't have terrific clinical people and systems to take care of her, but because mom was at home and care was in institutions. We've learned how to deliver very high quality care, in fact, very high value care inside of institutions. We have done a fairly poor job at trying to figure out how to take that expertise and bring it to people where and when they need it. So a tie back to American Telecare, a company started here back in the 90s by a physician and a nurse. Very simple premise. They felt they needed to be able to connect with people in their homes who often couldn't make it into care in a timely manner. Fast forward 15 years later, it's still an infant industry that's not supported hardly at all within the healthcare system. Best examples, probably our largest clientele is the Veterans Administration, where early studies that were published in the last several years showed that they could actually decrease nursing home admissions by 90%. They could reduce hospitalization by 65%. They could keep health care costs for sicker and sicker veterans flat as opposed to increasing in cost. A core part of what they did was the adoption of telemedicine. But telemedicine, I also, even though we're going to do a demonstration, I want to lay out, telemedicine is not about technology. And yes, we are a company that has technology, and there are other companies with technology, and technology is critical. The same way an operating room is critical for a surgeon to deliver a high-value operation. But if that surgeon doesn't come to the hospital when a trauma patient shows up with the need for surgery, that operating room is worthless. And if the surgeon shows up 2 days late, probably not a lot of good's going to be done. We have 40 million hospitalizations a year in this country. It's the major driver of healthcare cost. A lot of people end up from repeat hospitalizations in nursing homes. out of 40 million hospitalizations, 10 million people have procedures, which implies 30 million people, or 75%, do not. They're in the hospital typically for exacerbations of their chronic disease. And as a person who practiced internal medicine, and my passion and career was around people with very, very high needs, the sickest of the sick, I would tell you that I believe the vast majority of those 30 million hospitalizations should not need to take place. If we had a system that could monitor people in the home, could find out who was getting sick, and to direct our expert resources to those people first. Not, and this was a rude awakening for me, not as it occurred to me that I learned, it was a hard thing to swallow, that I would see 25 patients a day at the university. I had three department chairmen as my patients. I thought I must be a pretty good doctor. And then I realized after the fact that with those patients scheduled months in advance, because I might have been such a good doctor, what are the odds that those patients who were scheduled 3 months, 4 months in advance needed to see me that day and receive the value that I could offer? Meanwhile, I'm medical director of the emergency room, and I've got one of my patients in the emergency room on the way to the ICU that I should have seen 2 days ago, but I had no idea I could, I needed to, that I had the capacity, and that's the way our system works. So with that as a bit of a prelude, what I'd like to do is turn it over and say, as you look at this as an example of what technology can do as an enabler, think of it in terms of all we're trying to do is say, let's take the investment we've made in expert teams, in the ability to know how to take care of people and their diseases, and let's start matching expertise to need. Let's have the same teams that are largely bound because of the way we pay them inside of institutions, and move it into how those teams can be assigned to the highest need people in our population to proactively deliver care, to monitor them just like happens inside of a hospital, to find out when they start to deteriorate. And just as happens in a hospital, we don't respond in 2 days, we respond in minutes with the right person from the team. And that's what telemedicine can enable. The alternative is to continue to do what we do today, which is wait another couple of days or a week, and we will rescue them in the hospital with $15,000 or $20,000 of resources, and we'll do that two or three times, and then we'll pay for them to go to the nursing home. So, again, it's a passion of mine. I hope it can become a passion of yours. It's also a transformational pathway. 1% of the population uses 25% of the dollars. 5%, 55%. We can change by focusing on a very small percentage of people the core economics of healthcare, and we can fund transformation. With that, members of the committee, I will pause, and we will give a brief presentation with the warm support of Representative Huntley.
Thank you, Dr. Moore. Thank you for your comments, and I'm glad you described Representative Huntley as warm. That's very nice. Always a good thing when we're taking care of people. How would you like to proceed?
And with that, what we'd like to do is, first, what you're going to see is a system that, like happens in a hospital, the system allows the ability to take, if you will, and automate what would occur if a person could come to the hospital every day or several times there to the doctor's office, to ask the questions I would ask as a physician, and based on answers, generate new questions. So mass customized to the needs of the person. We are very confident that Representative Huntley doesn't have a lot of needs, so we'll try to keep it very simple. But the key is to be able to automate the ability to find out who may need assistance. And with that, I'm going to switch seats and elect Representative. This is a technology that sits into people's homes. Friendly, it's a computer. It'll do everything a computer can do, but it's not designed to look like feel like a computer. And with that, a session has been set up, and we have our clinician, Dr. Diamond, on the other side. And
so what a patient would do is the session would wake up at a specified time as set up by their clinician. It's been personalized to them based upon where they are in their chronic disease. and the specific things that that clinician is monitoring to make sure that that patient is stable in the home and looking for indications that they're not stable. The patient has the ability to then...
Good afternoon. Tap the continue button to proceed.
So the system is designed to be able to handle all
levels of
education.
How do you feel today? Good. Better than yesterday. Same as yesterday. Worse than yesterday. Bad.
It asks general questions. You can select one here. It is touchscreen sensitive.
Better than yesterday. Have you had any chest pain recently? No.
That's a good.
Is your shortness of breath worse than usual? No.
Whatever you'd like.
One. Place the cuff on
the
upper arm with the tube facing downward and on the inside of your arm.
Biological measures.
Two.
Taken blood pressure,
rest
weight,
your
glucose,
arm with your palm facing up on a flat surface.
Track and
three.
The patient's
turn
success.
On the blood pressure device by pressing the big button. Four. Remain still and quiet during testing. Five. The reading will be saved automatically.
So, Dr. Diamond, what you're saying here, it has an interactive mechanism that, such as blood pressure, some real basic assessment tools? Is that what you're saying?
Madam Chairman, correct. So the clinician can specify which vital signs, which peripherals they want to have. The patient can go through their question sets, collect that information. If you can go ahead and press the button, there's instructions on here. So if a patient forgets how to operate a particular medical peripheral, the instructions are always there and available. It has a lot of features to be very simplistic. If you can press the blue button. And the idea is, this is designed to be able to work with a patient as, you know, 80, 85 years old. So it's very, very simple in its approach. Right now we're measuring the blood pressure. It's designed so the readings actually just get transferred back to the system so that the clinician can have that information. And additionally, what we're going to see as soon as the vital sign is done, we're actually going to get contextual information. If you think about what happens when you go into a physician's office, not only do they take your vital signs, but they're also asking questions around, you know, did you smoke, did you drink, did you miss medications? And one of the challenges always when monitoring a patient, if you forget to ask that information, you can create false positives and cause the healthcare system to chase a lot of ghosts in the system.
Your blood
so the
pressure
system is designed to make sure that you don't
152.
So like this question
bottom,
here, it's asking what kind of reading is it? Is it sitting,
pulse,
lying down,
71.
Standing? And you can go ahead and select
what type
one.
Of reading is it? Sitting. Do you rest for 5 minutes before taking your blood pressure?
I'm sure it was
yes.
Very restful, Representative Huntley.
Did you smoke before? No.
Yes.
In front
of everybody.
Did you drink anything before taking your blood pressure? Yes. What did you drink? Coffee. People with CHF often take many different medications because each symptom must be treated.
And
this can
that
be confusing.
Can be very specific to where they're challenged in their current medical condition.
People with CHF sometimes
you
get confused about what medicine to take
if they
when.
Understand the education that's being presented to them.
People with CHF.
At the conclusion of
would
this
you
session,
like to
the
see
information then is sent
no.
back to the server. For the clinician to review.
Thank you for taking.
And this can be set up on an completely automated process.
Dr. Diamond, a question for you. You also mentioned that glucose levels. Does it have a also mechanism for taking blood tests to interface with some of the tools that are very frequently used on the market today for doing blood glucose testing?
The reason for setting up with computer technology is to be able to take input from any devices that would be allowed. So if CLIA regulations are allowed, yes, blood tests could be incorporated as well. It's basically designed, again, to try to get an interface into the home where it makes sense for people whose clinical condition can deteriorate fairly rapidly before the current system can respond. It could also be used in more of a management of hypertension, where when I took care of people with hypertension still today, we often get very infrequent readings. We get white coat syndrome, where people's blood pressure goes up when they're in the doctor's office. And there's no reason in the world why we shouldn't be seeing a series of daily blood pressures and changing medications on a very frequent basis and getting somebody in control instead of taking months or longer to do so. But the key, again, is to enable, and the next phase of this is if you can use a system that could, for clinical teams, identify who may be starting to deteriorate. So the glucose mention, a diabetic starts to show a trend that their glucose going up, which may be a sign of infection or something else, to spot that trend early before it becomes a critical nature, and then to be able to further assess a patient. So a key is to be able to actually do a physical exam remotely to be able to further assess and see what's happening.
And so on the screen that's up here, the clinician has the ability, if they have a panel of patients, 75, 100 patients, they can see which patients are having a significant issue that needs follow-up. So use color coding to be able to identify those patients. When you identify a need, you can then initiate a video visit with the patient into their home. And as a result, you can follow up and do about 70, 80% of what a clinician would do in person. What you can't do is you can't touch and smell the patient. Otherwise, you can do pretty much everything else that you would do if the patient was there with you.
I'd like you to think about this again from a transformation pathway for healthcare. Going back to my example, whether I'm a doctor or a nurse, if I'm seeing patients in clinic, I can see a lot. They have to be pre-scheduled in advance. If I'm going into their home, a nurse will typically do 5 visits in a day. With telemedicine, the same nurse can do 12 to 15 visits in a day. And for either the doctor or the nurse, instead of seeing the patient who was scheduled in advance, they're prioritizing to the person who's showing a trend of needing help. So out of maybe a panel of 75 patients, you've identified the 5 to 10 who really need help that day. Dramatically increases the efficiency and impact of our healthcare resources.
Thank you very much, Dr. Moore. Dr. Diamond, my regrets, but our time is over for this committee. Thank you for being here. Very interesting, very informative, and thank you, Representative Huntley, for being our guinea pig for today. Very gracious of you to do that. This meeting is now adjourned. Thank you.